wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sound stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Colt, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does this speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's
and that's News Goo by Polarity One, a song about the media that was produced for the Media and Democracy Congresses a long time ago. Joining me now from Wisconsin, Robert McChesney, Robert W. McChesney, one of the leading professors and analysts and intellectuals dealing with the media in the world and certainly in the United States. He's a professor at the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is somebody who has been writing books. He's written some 23 books, translated into 31 languages officially. He's appeared at 800 different presentations at various conferences, 1,000 radio and TV appearances, he's the man to know and the place to go when you want to know about the media in America. He's also a friend of mine, and I'm pleased to welcome him to Media Channel Radio to get your assessment, Bob, of where we are in the media debate today. But before we do that, I think it would be interesting for people to know a little bit more about you. For example, in looking up some information about you, I found out that you started in journalism in sports as a stringer. And then you went on to found The Rocket, a rock and roll magazine in Seattle that's been credited with the whole Seattle musical explosion there. So tell me a little bit about how you got into the whole media thing.
Well, Danny, good to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. If you really want to go back further, and this isn't part of the record, there was a strike of all the major daily newspapers in Cleveland, Ohio, where I grew up in 1962 in the fall. And all the papers stopped publishing for several months. And as a result of that, when the strike was settled, all the paper boys had sort of gone off to do other things, and it was all boys then. And I lived on a street with 50 houses on it, and I was, I think, 9 years old, and they came up, they were driving around desperate for paper boys, and they asked me to become the paper boy, even though I was far too young to handle a route that size, and I took it as a paper boy for the next, I don't know, 7 years or 6 years. And I would get up then every morning and pretty much read the paper cover to cover starting at that age. I was up so early, didn't have much else to do. And that was my beginning, and I think I've had an attraction to journalism, to media, ever since then. And then you mentioned some of the stuff I did after I finished school, working both as a sports stringer for UPI when I was living in Seattle, and then starting The Rocket, the rock magazine out in Seattle, back in 1979.
You know, just to compliment your story with a little bit of my own, I think it was at age 3 that my father allowed me to walk up the block that we lived on in the Bronx and pick up a copy of the New York Times, then selling for 3 cents, and walk back down the block and bring it to him. I was very proud of myself. Of course, he kept me under surveillance throughout that whole long walk, but nevertheless, that introduced me to the whole culture of newspapers. I also helped distribute the New York Times on Sundays, first in a neighborhood co-op housing development I grew up in, and then at Cornell University as a paying gig on weekends to bring the newspaper to nearby colleges. So, getting into newspapering in the distribution phase, I think, sort of interested you in the newspaper as a business and the media as a business. And so maybe it was a short leap to go from that background into journalism. But for you, it's been a very deep immersion in journalism. What was the defining interest, influence, or forces that led you to realize that this would be part of your life's work?
Well, I can still remember the day that I was realized there was something important with media beyond the self-evident, which was in 1972, I was working as a voter registration activist or organizer, trying to organize 18-year-olds to vote the first presidential election that people under 21 could vote. And I was in the East Bay in California working in Oakland and Berkeley. And we were doing all these organizing campaigns to get people to register to vote in the fall election that year. And what I remember was one day we did a big event at a shopping center, a strip mall in Oakland, and we got a lot of news media out to cover it. And we were trying to register a bunch of people to vote, not just young people, but basically anyone who wanted to vote. It was a big drive. And I remember we were all excited that the news media covered. So that night we went back and we turned on the evening news, and we saw the reports on two of the channels that covered it. And they completely missed what this thing was about. They had the story wrong. They gave the complete wrong impression. And it was very jarring for me to realize that, you know, these news reports could miss that story so badly. And it made me think, I wonder if they're missing other stories as badly as this. You know, it sort of jarred my confidence in news media providing a credible picture of what was going on in the world. And I think at that moment I said, I've got to look a little bit more into this. This seems like an important issue that I haven't really thought much about. So that was, I think, a trigger event for me when I was 19 years old. And at that point, I always, even when I was studying economics in college and politics, I always had an eye on media. I knew that's where I would eventually end up. It was just something I was tuned into.
Well, you know, of course, for many activists, you know, the telling experiences, taking part in some giant rally or movement or march, and then, you know, seeing how it was covered and often not covered in the media, even though media people might have been there, doesn't necessarily mean that the story is given any attention or given any certainly prominent attention. So you could have a half a million people go to Washington for a demonstration, and maybe there would be a picture on the front page, or if there was a counter protest of 10 people, that would get equal attention to the march that you were part of. And I think that began this process of understanding that although we were supporters of freedom of the press and believed deeply in it, the press itself didn't seem to be free.
That's absolutely right. And I think it sort of opened the door to sort of thinking critically about what it means to have a news media that gives citizens the information they need to participate effectively in self-government. And that seems like a banal statement. That seems like something that's asserted out of classic liberal theory. But I believe that. I believe you got to have that. I don't see any way you can have a decent society without that. And I know you believe that, or you wouldn't do the work you do, Danny. And I suspect the people listening to the show believe that, or they wouldn't be listening to this network. And it's something we've got to accomplish if we're going to have a society worth living in. And we have to have it accomplish it if we're going to be able to solve the immense problems that really require democratic participation, or else they're not going to get solved.
Well, it interests me that you told us the story of your involvement in trying to get, you know, 18-year-olds to vote. And voting, of course, is the one way that most people in this country interface with their government. That's what makes our democracy, as imperfect as it is, at least having the claim to be a democracy, because people can turn out to vote. And yet, most recently, you've written about, with John Nichols, the money and media election complex. And your views on voting and what's happened to our electoral system seems to have evolved dramatically from being a kind of maybe uncritical booster of it, feeling it was a sort of civic duty to go out there and get people to register, as certainly I felt during the civil rights movement. You know, we were at the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Summer and the deaths of the civil rights workers there who died as part of this struggle for the right to vote. So this is not something that is an abstraction to most people. But yet today, there seems to be an ugly caricature of what democracy is, which you know, label the money and media election complex. What are you referring to there?
Well, that's such a great question. And I could give a 40-minute lecture just touching on all the important points.
Oh, okay. I have 40 minutes. Go ahead. No,
go get a bologna sandwich and a beer, Danny. Come back at 6 o'clock. No, but I mean,
spoken, I might add, like a true son of the Midwest, speaking, we don't talk about bologna sandwiches in New York anymore, except when we talk about politicians, perhaps. But okay, move forward here. The money and media election complex.
You know, John Nichols and I wrote this book, Dollarocracy, which came out about a year ago. And it was, you know, our concern we've had working together for 15 years, being good friends, with the immense amount of money that goes into election campaigns on one hand, which was, you know, then blown asunder by the Citizens United decision in 2010 by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has just opened the floodgates of money, which already were extraordinary. And that what that means for American elections on one hand, and then the other side of the same coin was how we had a collapse of political journalism in this country such that there's very little journalism covering any races, any political issues in this country. And what journalism there was tended to be, you know, not especially helpful. Lots of gossip, trivia, silliness, spin, talking about commercials. And so we've said there's now this huge media and money election complex of funders, donors, consultants, corporate media that are making a fortune on our election system, and our elections are shriveling up and becoming utterly worthless as a means for citizens to engage in the system. So that's the best system that we were talking about. And, you know, one of the things, for example, Danny, that I don't think Americans fully realize, unless they've been outside the country while there have been national elections in other countries, is how much more money Americans spend per capita or per voter on elections than any other country. For example, in 2013, less than a year ago, Germany held national elections and reelected the Christian Democratic government, but they were national elections. And for every dollar that was spent per voter by parties and candidates in 2013 in Germany, we spent on our national elections, just Congress and the White House, per voter, so it's balanced by population, in the United States, $34. We outspent Germany 34-1. In elections.
Does this central fact get covered very much in your reading of the media? In other words, is there a focus on money in politics at all, or is it just a line that's used routinely without much detail being offered?
Yeah, it's rarely covered seriously. There is great investigative work being done, but it's usually being done by freelance reporters, people working for groups like the Center for Media and Democracy out of Madison, which does some great research, or ProPublica occasionally. Even the New York Times has Nick Confessori's done some really good reporting on it. But, you know, the fact that you can name the handful of people who actually cover the issue and put them on one hand, two if you're lucky, tells you all you need to know about how it's not covered, how it's just not an issue, how its information is unknown. And I think the crucial point here, there's a lot of them, but the one to follow up on the 34-1 outspending Germany per voter, what we spend, is that the U.S. Supreme Court in its Citizens United decision, really one of the most corrupt and despicable decisions in the Supreme Court history, for reasons we go into in the book, but that decision argued, the majority opinion argued, that money equals speech and more spending would be more democracy. It would not be corrupting. That the point of spending was not corruption or buying influence, but rather the point of all that spending was simply to increase the ability of people to participate. It was a good thing. And instead, you know, the evidence is obvious. It's just the opposite. The more money that gets spent in elections, the more bogus they are. No one in Germany would trade elections with us. No one in any other country, anywhere in the world, would trade elections with us. Our election system is a scandal everywhere in the world. Jimmy Carter, who runs the Carter Center, which has monitored, you know, 100 elections roughly in the last 25 years.
In other countries.
In every country except the United States, it seems like. The Carter Center said they would not monitor an American election because you don't even meet baseline standards for an honest election in this country. They couldn't vouch for the results. But they're comfortable doing this, vouching for the results in, you know, Belarus and Ukraine and all sorts of other places.
Well, one of the issues you point out here, it's not just that money, you know, raids, you know, or determines electoral outcomes, but also it influences the narrative of the issues themselves that we have come to understand because of all the money invested in commercials, most of them negative. The narrative, comes from broadcast and cable TV stations, but paid for by economic elites that define, not in your words, not just the results of an election, but the scope and character of government itself. Explain.
Well, you're absolutely right. The question almost answered itself in the sense that you've laid out the problem. The TV political advertisement has become the unit of currency of American politics, and it is how people participate. They cost a fortune. You have to pay corporate broadcasters a fortune to get on the air. It takes lots of ads to be effective, and their ads are almost entirely worthless. They're incredibly offensive. They're overwhelmingly negative. And now we're in the new era, post-Citizens United, in which money doesn't go directly to campaigns as much. Some does. But more often than not, it's going to these shadowy third-party groups where who's giving the money is unknown, how they're spending it isn't really easy to track. And they're putting up all these ads, or a significant percentage of them, and these ads are almost entirely negative attack ads.
I mean, it's such a cynical process, okay, where the TV stations are just sort of taking orders. In New York a few years back, ABC, the network I used to work for, the Eyewitness or Eyewitless news team, added 5 minutes to the election, their election coverage at election time for back-to-back advertising. No context, no explanation. They just ran ad after ad after ad, all of them sort of canceling each other out, completely unwatchable. But it was a way that, they can justify taking this money because the ads got on the air, even if no one watched them.
In Dollarocracy, we have story after story like that, even much worse. We also have research that shows, tragically, that in an absence of journalism, of credible journalism covers races, ads actually work pretty well because there's not much else to go on. There's been research done, for example, with voters who, in focus groups before elections, will always say, hey, I would never listen to those ads. I hate them. They're terrible. I especially don't like negative ads. I think anyone who does those is a horrible human. And then they'll meet with the same voters after the election, and they'll ask them who they voted for and who they didn't vote for. And what researchers find is that people invariably, when they criticize a candidate they didn't vote for, are invoking whatever was the content of the negative ads.
In other words, the message points get through and get assimilated by people because they're buzz terms, and they can remember that. And they just spit it back out.
There's no countervailing information. It's not like we have – look, negative ads don't work – with people who really follow politics closely and consume journalism, take it very seriously. To them, the advertising is just a form of manipulation. It's a strategy, a tactic. And if we had a sufficient journalism, everyone would qualify. They would look at these ads and laugh and say, get this garbage out of my face. But in an absence of journalism, in an absence of a press system that's covering politics remotely, credibly, people are left at the mercy of the barrage of ads that pummel them for months and months.
But you don't just indict the donors or the Koch brothers, or you indict the media industry itself, which is part of and complicit with this whole travesty. They're making billions of dollars on these ads. It's a profit center for them. And, they are not obligated, to present all sides in at all. I mean, they're in a situation where they can pretty much write their own rules.
It's utterly criminal. I don't mean to keep trying to get people to look at our book, but we actually go into the detail of how criminal it is, because commercial broadcasters, all broadcasters in the United States, radio and television, get monopoly licenses for scarce channels in their community that are extremely valuable. They make a lot of money off them, even today, especially because of political ads. And these broadcasters get them because theoretically or legally they're going to serve the public interest. And the way that public interest has been defined by the courts and by the Federal Communications Commission means that they will do something they wouldn't do if they were just out to maximize profit. They're justified in getting this scarce license because they're doing something in the public interest. And the number one thing that has been come up by the courts and the FCC, and what does it mean, public interest coverage for a broadcaster, is covering local elections. That's the one thing voters citizens really want and need from their local broadcasters, lots of coverage of races in their community so they can participate in politics. And what we find, and the research shows, is commercial broadcasters have completely abandoned that. They couldn't care less about that because they know the FCC isn't enforcing it, and their own, not all the local stations are owned by more than a dozen companies. I mean, they're just raking in the chips.
In journalism, we talk about following the money, but you do some of that in this book, talking about how 30-second spots that went for $2,000 in 2008 were jacked up to $5,000 in the last election cycle. And much of the money goes to stations owned by a handful of Fortune 500 firms. No wonder, you guys add, station owners oppose campaign finance reform. Their lobby role in Washington is similar to the NRA's in battling bans on assault weapons. In other words, they have a stake in the system, and thank you very much. We'd like to continue it the way it is.
It's worse than that. In fact, this commercial broadcaster spent all of 2012 battling so they did not have to make what they're legally obligated is to say who buys ads on their stations and who paid for the ads. The public has a right to know that. And the commercial broadcasters have to do that legally, but they have it printed in their offices and records. You have to go to their offices and ask to see them, which is almost impossible for most people to do. So there was a movement that will make this stuff available online so citizens have a right to see who's paying for these ads. And the commercial broadcasters, instead of saying, okay, that's a great idea, we've got it all digital, no problem for us, thought that because they understood that they're going to get less money from these politicians and these third-party groups if the identity of who's paying for the ads is known to the public, even though that's their legal right. They fought to keep it secret so they could make more money from these clandestine groups buying ads.
All right, so for more information on this, your book Dollarocracy goes into it in detail. Now, I'm sure you must be very happy by two developments that took place today, which you may not know about, you may know about. First, that apparently here in New York City, the General Electric sign on top of Rockefeller Center, the headquarters of NBC, is going to be changed to Comcast and at GE, which has been up there for 20 years, is out and Comcast is in. So I'd like to know what you think about that. And the second has to do with the governor of your own state there in Wisconsin, who's now being prosecuted criminally for some campaign violations, among other things. So comment on these things that are in our face. Comcast towering over the skyscrapers of Rockefeller Center.
Comcast is a particularly, it's really a post town for American capitalism today. Comcast started as a cable company out of Philadelphia, and cable companies, most Americans don't realize this is a monopoly industry. Every cable company has a local monopoly license. They have no competition from other cable companies. So they have a monopoly once they get a local license. So it's been a very lucrative industry, and they built up an empire of cable licenses around the country, and they've lobbied aggressively to expand the number of cable systems they could own. And then they lobbied aggressively so they could do something that was once illegal. They bought a television network which owns a lot of TV stations. So they own both television stations and a cable company. And then finally, where most Americans are becoming to get to know Comcast is they're the number one wire broadband provider in the country. They're making tons of money offering broadband internet access to the cable modem system. And so they've become this colossal company, one of the 30 largest companies in the world.
And about to merge with Time Warner Cable if they're allowed to do it.
Yeah, and again, this is a merger that doesn't even pass the giggle test. I mean, this would have been shot down, thrown out, not even considered as recently as 5 years ago. There's simply no justification for it economically. It doesn't improve efficiency. It doesn't help consumers. It's just purely a gift to the shareholders of these two companies to let them have even more monopoly power. So this is a company that is basically, there's nothing free market about Comcast. These guys wouldn't know a free market if they kicked them in the butt. Their entire business model is getting monopoly licenses, having a fleet of seven-figure paid lobbyists who are usually former politicians that flood Washington, D.C., all the state capitals. So they own the politicians. They always get their way. And so they can pull off these deals. I mean, this is a company that is a poster child of crony capitalism, of the corruption of our times, and that they sit atop the media, says everything we need to know about the caliber of our media system today.
And here in
now, as for Scott Walker, I haven't seen that news. I've been away from it. Wasn't in the morning paper, and I've been away from the.
Yeah, prosecutors have announced plans to prosecute him for various violations, including electoral issues. So it was very interesting that, you know, here's somebody who positioned himself as, you know, cleaning up the corruption in state politics, fighting the unhealthy control by the unions and all the rest of it, and now might be brought down through an act by prosecutors who, under this administration, have not exactly been super aggressive in going after violations by people in power.
Well, that's pretty mild. And, you know, I haven't seen the exact facts. I've read articles about suggesting what Walker was being investigated for. I do know from studies, being in Wisconsin and seeing him in action for a long time, he is someone who is completely a flunky of big money, without shame. But his specialty is basically looking you in the eye and just saying, you know, I'm here to work for working class people, as he's shafting them. He's an extraordinarily shameless human. So that doesn't mean he's guilty of the crimes he's charged of, but it does mean he's a person of almost no character.
Well, did these issues get fair coverage with, you know, the fight against some of his policies and the you know, battle at the state capitol in Madison, your hometown? You know, did these issues get the kind of media attention they deserved?
You know, it was really disappointing. But think. Given the massive public uprising that we saw in Wisconsin in 2011, where extraordinary that you had, you know, people on their own, without it being organized, tens of thousands coming down to protest Walker's efforts to eliminate public sector unions. After running for office without even mentioning it, that he would do this, and then suddenly the day he's sworn in, said, now I want to get rid of public sector unions, after getting elected without mentioning it, you know, 6 weeks earlier, you would think that this would have drawn our best reporters to really get to the bottom of this and really study it and examine it, not just locally, but nationally. And the news coverage, unfortunately, really was really an indictment of how low our news media has become. And by indictment, what I mean is that the core critique of political journalism in America for some time, and Danny, you've dissected it as well as anyone, is that reporters tend to basically report at face value what people in power say. They let people in power talk about what they want to talk about. And the only time you get any real debate is when they're arguing with each other over some point. But if they're in agreement, it's off limits. And they're very loath to ever accuse someone in power, governor or president, of being a liar, even if they know it's a lie. Instead, basically, they say, we report and we'll let readers determine it's a lie, but we don't want to be accused of being partisan or ideological, so we're going to stay away from that.
Isn't that the Fox television mantra, we report, you decide?
Yeah. So if Scott Walker tells a blatant lie or is being deceptive, which he's routinely, rather than having the news report say that, they basically let the Democrats accuse him of that. Then they say, look, we'll report the Democrats accusing Scott Walker of being a liar. Well, people understandably say, well, of course the Democrats are going to accuse him of that, and Scott Walker will accuse the Democrats of being liars. That's what politicians do. We need journalism that actually tells us that someone is lying, and that's what we weren't getting. And so it makes it a liar's paradise. You can basically spin your way out of any crisis, really, because the newspaper will report what you say and take it seriously, even when they know it's baloney. And, of course, as you know, one of the reasons why Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and John Oliver have had such success is all they have to do is flaunt the idiocy of that convention, and people laugh hysterically, because when you think about it, the comments of these politicians are so absurd, and the news media coverage is the only thing more absurd.
Well, listen, I want to get a little bit beyond some of this into some of your work about capitalism, some of your work about the system itself beyond what we see or don't see in the media. So please stand by and stay with us. Robert McChesney will be back in a minute with more. God. Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Robert McChesney, professor, author, analyst, activist, really, in Wisconsin, talking to us not only about his reviews and analysis of the media and our political system, but what's behind it? What is actually going on in the system that we live in? Now, one thing about Bob McChesney is that he is also very interested in the theory and the practice of economics. He studied it, and he's part of the team involved with the magazine Monthly Review that's gone on for many years, offering a really far more critical look at the American economy and the crisis of capitalism that we're part of right now. How does this tie in your view, to what we're seeing in the media here?
Well, I think it sets the stage and context to understand how the media operate, the context they operate within at a number of different levels. But they are distinct areas, too, and oftentimes the research doesn't exactly overlap. They complement each other, and I couldn't imagine doing any of the media work I do or political work I do without having, an insight into how our economic system works. It goes beyond the banalities and the cliches of any side and sort of really appreciates what capitalism looks like. When I was a young man, going back to the early 70s again, it didn't take me long to figure out. By the time I was 18 or 19, it was pretty obvious that the pursuit of profit pretty much drove how our society worked. You didn't have to, that was the best explanation. But how that played out exactly, I wanted to get a better sense of. So I studied economics in college. It was my major, mainstream economics. I wanted to understand economics from a capitalist perspective. And I went into business. I was a publisher, actually. Made payrolls, paid taxes. I sort of got into the marketplace and saw how it worked to appreciate it and understand what a capitalist would think like, because I already knew what a worker would think like from that experience. And, it's been a big part of my analysis. And I think in a nutshell, Danny, what I would say is that the school of thought I come from, which is a left-wing, left Marxist / Keynesian, that's really a heterogeneous, heterodox economics, the concern we have, the analysis we have, is that capitalism has a strong tendency towards stagnation, that is the great problem of the way capitalism works at a certain point in time. And it's a complex issue, but one way to put it so listeners can grasp what I'm getting at, the United States economy today, per worker, produces vastly more per worker than it did 40 years ago. Yet the standard of living hasn't increased vastly for people in the last 40 years. It's been relatively stagnant, and in some cases it's declined. And that's because we have an economic system that at a certain point can produce more and more and more, but it can't successfully or profitably make money off of what it could produce because of the way it's structured. And that, in my view, is the fundamental flaw of capitalism. It's Achilles' heel, so to speak. And that's what Keynes has tried to deal with, what Krugman writes about in the New York Times, how do you deal with this problem? And it's a worldwide problem. It's, I think, going to be the defining problem of our generation until it's resolved.
Well, I took a short break from writing about media to focus in on the financial crisis. In 2005, I began researching debt in America with the idea that this was an issue that could actually bring people together, because so many people were coping with burdens of debt that they couldn't possibly manage or pay off, sinking deeper and deeper. And in that film that I made, In Debt We Trust, we predicted a financial crisis. It was pretty obvious that this was an unsustainable economic situation that we were in. Now, the response to my film was I was an alarmist, I was a doom and gloomer, I didn't know what I was talking about, there was no way, didn't I know how great things were going, look at real estate, look at this, look at that. And so suddenly, I was on the margins. Then something happened, i.e. a financial crisis of the type that we were warning against. And suddenly I went from being a zero to a hero. Oh, you're a genius. I wasn't a genius, obviously. Then I made a subsequent film called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and wrote a book about it, because I felt like what has not been reported in an unholy alliance between the media and the finance industry is the pervasive fraud and crime that is taking place. Not only how it's hurting the majority of Americans, but how it's created a cannibalistic culture where, you know, young people want to be CEOs. They want to go into the business world. That's their they go into business school and all the rest of it. And at the same time, they're caught up in a set of values that takes them really far away from what they claim to have believed in the first place. You must see that with students that you teach.
Yeah, I think students are desperate. The culture is, you know, really giving them a little hold on to value, and this is sort of what you're inundated in. It seems like the only thing you can do. I want to get back to your point, though, because you were absolutely ahead of the curve, at least among journalists. With very little company prior to the crash, highlighting the problems of financialization. But, you know, this has been a big part of my economic analysis, too, because most people view financialization as the cause of the crisis. And if we had just reined in the banks and we had just kept Glass-Steagall and we just enforced the laws, then capitalism would have been in good shape and just gone along swimmingly. I don't think financialization was the cause as much as a symptom, as an effect of stagnation. The economy turned to financialization in the late 70s and thereafter, basically as a means to battle stagnation, as a way to stimulate growth. And this financialization also means the massive growth of debt to create demand for products that wouldn't have been there without the growth of debt. So it was really a symptom, not a cause of capitalism's problems. And that's why we're still out of the woods. That's why even reinstituting Glass-Steagall, while it would be helpful to have firmer regulation on financial institutions, would be great to lock up all these crooks who gained the system. We're still not out of the woods. It's really a more fundamental problem.
You work with students who have great aspirations and great hopes, and then soon find out that there are very few jobs to find, despite their educational advancement and carrying around, a chain around their neck of student debt, which is now equal to mortgage debt, you know, a few years back in terms of the aggregate, of it. And so we have a situation where the future can't look very good, and I've been reading about young people being sort of demonized in our culture and targeted, in essence, by violence, by police, and you know, a very repressive environment. How do we get people to understand that when often they're willing to vote against their own interests?
Well, you know, it's heartbreaking to travel around and talk to college kids and teach college kids and have college-age children myself and see their friends and to see how many young people today have been dealt a hand that is unrecognizable to the world. I entered in late 60s, early 70s, and you entered a few years before that. The labor market today for young people.
Thanks for calling attention to that age gap and disparity. I'm sure you did so in the interest of honoring your ancestors. Thank you.
Well, I did so. It's a favor. I just said a few years, Danny. I didn't put the exact number on it out of respect for your youthful appearance. And, but it's a hard – the situation facing young people today is probably arguably the worst labor market since the 1930s. In the United States, and there are lots of other places in the world where it's even worse. Go to Greece or go to Spain. I mean, it's unbelievable what's going on. And when you put in the debt, the tremendous downward pressure on wages, it is a very dark picture. It's why I think we're entering a period of profound change. And, you know, people say, well, Occupy came and went, the Wisconsin protests came and went, nothing happened, been there, done that. I think those were just sort of flickers in the stream before you know what hits the fan, because this is an untenable situation. And, we have people who are talented, gifted people who should be in a position where they can do great things with their lives and have great lives and produce for society, create for society, you know, working, making coffee or mowing lawns or nannying, nothing on nannying, but I mean, they're doing whatever they can at pretty much low-wage jobs just to survive. I think we have a high percentage of kids in their mid-20s still living with their parents, much higher than ever before. And then the debt situation you talked about. All of this suggests a political economic system that's in decline, And the fact that our political system is incapable of addressing these problems suggests we have a political system that is marching along with it into decline.
You know, it's also interesting because I'm doing a series now about surveillance, the surveillance state, and about, you know, Ed Snowden, 29 years old, you know, kind of a hacker, didn't graduate from high school, who goes to work in the NSA and, you know, sees what's really going on and feels an obligation to say something about it. You know, if you see something, say something. And he did so in a very clever way. And what it seems as if that despite the fact that, you know, we talk so much about normalcy in our society, people in power are really scared. They're really worried. They know this situation is not sustainable, is untenable, and they are doing everything they can to ratchet up repression, surveillance, intimidation of people, the criminalization of young people in our prison system, for example, in schools that are becoming like prisons and all the rest of it. There seems to be a lot of anxiety in high places that, you know, we don't fully appreciate, because they realize that the danger here of an uprising right here in America.
There's no question about it. And it doesn't get talked about. This show might be the only place it's getting talked about in the whole year for the most part. But, one of the striking things that's going on in America is, you know, we have the lowest voter turnout rate in the world, basically, for elections, especially if you factor in our local elections. It's well below just about anyone else. And people say, well, what's wrong with Americans? Why don't they vote? If you look, study the system closely, I think you can make a pretty strong argument. It's amazing we get as many people who vote as do. It's really a credit to how badly Americans want a democracy that we could get 50% of the population out at a national election or 35% at a congressional election. And you consider how gerrymandering and money is pretty much turned this, you know, into an undemocratic country. So we have a low voter turnout. But even with a low voter turnout that is heavily skewed towards the wealthiest 20% of Americans, or 25%, who voted at a much higher rate than the poorest 25% of Americans, even with that, people in power are freaked out. Even with this minimal turnout, minimal democracy, they can't sell their policies. They're having trouble. So we've seen this obscene growth of efforts in the last 5 years to restrict voting from African Americans, by young people, by poor people, basically. This has been done shamelessly, out in the open, in state after state, including Wisconsin. And it's all about saying we got to rig the elections. We can't, our policies can't win a fair election.
Yeah, and this
even when you're only getting 35% of the vote, even when it's skewed heavily towards wealthy people, we still can't win an election.
And this on the anniversary of the civil rights movement and all the martyrs, all the people who fought for the right for all to vote. This is what we're confronting today, and it looks like some constituencies have either been bought off or are asleep at the switch, don't recognize what's happening. You know, it's like once you turn back the clock, you can't turn it forward again, okay, very easily. And I think that what we're not seeing enough in our media is these threats to at least the values of democracy, much less the reality of it. So, you know, we're in a situation where the right to vote is at risk. But, you know, we're also talking about what are we voting for? Do we have choices? And how do we assure that we will have choices? And our media is not very helpful in that respect.
No, I think, you know, they dropped the ball entirely. I mean, one of the most depressing things to do in America are pretty much a political debate for people who care about politics is largely taking place on cable television news for the vast majority of Americans who say, I really want to care about elections and politics. That's where they say, I'm going to go and I'm going to sample that fare. And the inanity of what passes for political coverage on all those networks, all of them, I mean, discussions of Hillary Clinton's campaign, you know, 3 years before the election, on inane stuff about whether she should pat her dog or what color clothes she should wear or how she should spin this or that. And not just Hillary Clinton, just right on down the list. As all these great issues you and I have been talking about the last 4 minutes, getting out a scintilla of coverage. Says everything we need to know about the crisis of media in this country.
And yet, you've been working very hard with Organization Free Press to try to do something about it, campaigning for net neutrality. Where does that stand now in this era of Barack Obama as our president, who said he was for net neutrality until he wasn't so sure he was for it?
Well, net neutrality is, you know, where I think most of your listeners are familiar with this, but it's basically the idea that the cable and cell phone companies that basically have a cartel. Access to the Internet in the United States is controlled by a cartel. Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast have divided up the market between themselves. They don't compete. And they have this incredible gold mine. If you want to have a cell phone or access, wire access, so you go through those three companies or three other subsidiaries.
And they overcharge, don't they, relative to what people in other parts of the world are paying?
Yeah, what do cartels do? Cartels divvy up the market. They charge much more, and then they have no competitive pressure to invest in their network. So Americans pay much more for their cell phones and their broadband access than people in almost any other country in the world, and they get much crappier service. It's quite clear. We're falling down the list of all the rankings of broadband and cell phone access every year because this cartel is making such a fortune, and they own all the politicians. These are all, again, government-created companies. They're not free market companies. So these companies desperately want to change the way the Internet has worked. People think the Internet was this magical system that no government could interfere with a corporation because you could go online and no one could stop you. There was something magical about technology. Well, that wasn't the case. The reason why the Internet seemed that way is that we had a policy from our old days of public interest telephone regulation called common carrier status, which meant that the ISP, originally the phone company and the cable companies, had to treat all websites and all users equally. They couldn't discriminate against them. So they had to provide their service to everyone at the same price. And they couldn't, try to shake people down who had more money. And this is the reason why any website could go on and not worry about getting censored. They had to be treated the same way as Microsoft's website or General Motors' website would be treated. Well, the cable companies and the cell phone companies, that cartel of AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, hate that principle. Because as soon as they can start charging more for some websites that have high-speed access over others, then they can turn into basically a souped-up cable television. They can make a fortune shaking people down to get them to pay more to get through. And then they have the power then to throw people onto a dirt path or kick them off altogether if they have the ability to do that. And the principle of net neutrality basically was to maintain the rule that basically all websites, all users paid equal, and this cartel doesn't have a right to engage in censorship. They can't use their bottleneck control to privatize the
Internet. Isn't it ironic in a way that the person fighting all this most visibly recently is British, a comedian on HBO, John Oliver, formerly of The Daily Show, who's one of the few people who's actually calling on the audience to get involved and to respond, to flood the FCC with comments. You know, most of our media describes their good in problem statement. They're not very good in problem solution. They certainly are hostile to public participation. And Oliver has been jumping around on stage, and people have been responding to it in droves.
Well, Danny, guess what? What cable TV news network would you expect to probably be sympathetic to network neutrality? The one you would expect to be MSNBC. Well, guess who owns MSNBC?
Comcast.
And guess Comcast is, they're the ones who benefit by getting rid of network neutrality. So you hold your breath. You're going to hold it a long time waiting for Rachel Maddow to do serious investigation of this issue, serious investigation of the forces of God, new journalism on it. You know, this is basically, I think, you know, if you work at MSNBC, you make your pact with the devil. You say, okay, I'm not going to touch Comcast, and I'm not going to go after them, and I'll keep my job. And
what was interesting about Oliver, he was going after Time Warner, his own company. I mean, maybe he doesn't know better, but he certainly got a tremendous response and respect from the audience for being a truth teller on the air, of which, you know, increasingly there are far fewer, if you will, than there have been. Although I must say, you know, you've certainly gotten a little bit of visibility with Bill Moyers and other shows, but I don't see you holding forth on MSNBC very much.
No, and I think the fact that you pointed to John Oliver points to something else, which is that, you know, in our political culture, it's a signal about the problems of our political culture that the only people who can tell the truth or at least go after people in power with any degree of impunity are comedians. If someone's not a comedian, it's the same thing. It'd be much harder.
And also, well, I know that very well. I'm trying to work on my stand-up, Bob, to try to be a little funnier. Right now, I'm just funny looking, not funny in what I have to say. But what I find is that one of the problems with shows like The Daily Show, for example, is it really appeals more to attitude than to people seeking information. You know, it's very easy to laugh at, quote, the bad guys or the stupid statement that's made or Sarah Palin or whatever, than to recognize that we're dealing with a system here that not only encourages those people, but neutralizes or neuters the range of debate that we should be having.
You know, in fairness to those shows, and I'd put, you know, Stewart and Colbert and Oliver together, and there's probably some others I'm forgetting. I think they're great for what they do. I think all three of those shows are won by people I would consider comic geniuses. They're gifted. And I don't think it's fair to put on a comedian's back the onus of a political culture. I think if we had a credible political culture, they probably would run out of material then. They depend on being in a desert and offer water. But I think the other comedians, and I think they're some obligations ethically, but I got other places I'm looking first before I go after them for the flaws in our political culture.
Well, what next for you, Bob McChesney? You've been at this for a long time with your colleagues. You've been fighting this fight. There have been ups, and most recently there have been downs. What keeps you going? What is your forecast?
This is what keeps me going. I am, and Danny, I'd be interested to hear your take on this. I'm convinced that the American people right now are far more progressive than they've ever been in my lifetime. From my own experience, giving lots of public talks, oftentimes to not sympathetic audiences, dealing with lots of different types of folks in this country, I think there's an openness to progressive ideas, to critical analysis of how things work that hasn't existed in my lifetime. And this goes back even to the 70s, when I sort of came of age, the early 70s. I think that the jingoism, the sort of various sort of wedge issues that have traditionally been used to bolster right-wing politics in this country and in the status quo are weaker today than they've been in my lifetime, considerably weaker. I don't think you can use the race card and white racism to the same. You still can use it. It's still being used. Don't get me wrong. It still exists very much. But it doesn't have the same political power it had 30 or 40 years ago, or God knows 50 years ago. So I'm optimistic because I think we've got the numbers on our side. I think there is a progressive majority in this nation that desperately wants to get this country to reach the ideal, to reach, you know, fulfill the ideals that were central to its founding. And our better angels have always enunciated, from Paine and Jefferson to Lincoln to Martin Luther King. And so I'm confident there. I think the people in power know that. And that gives me confidence, too. The fact that they've got to go to such great ends to undermine the vote, spin propaganda, they know that they can't win a fair fight. That's what gets me going. I would only get depressed if I thought the vast majority of people were buying in happily with the system. Then I would give up.
Well,
we're nowhere near that. It's going quickly in the opposite direction.
Well, I would say amen to that. I mean, it certainly is the hope that keeps me going and that drives our efforts to try to do something about our media system in a culture where media is such a dominant force. We're back online with MediaChannel.org trying to offer a more varied, fair, of analysis and information, hoping that will help inform this community of people who are looking and searching for answers and for an understanding of what's behind what's going on. Sometimes it's not always obvious what's really going on behind it all, like this you know, army that are suddenly emerged in Iraq. You know, when the NSA is spying on you and me, Putin is going into Crimea, and there's an uprising in Iraq, and apparently the last people to know about it are the intelligence agencies. So that's not new, but it's certainly indicative, you know, of a deeper problem. So I want to just thank you, Robert McChesney, for the work you do, for the all the generations of students you've been teaching, all the articles you write and speeches you give, and for being with me here on MediaChannel.org radio and sharing your views. How do people reach you?
You go online, just Google my name, and you'll see everything you want to know about me and contact information, too.
Well, there you go. Robert W. McChesney, one of our great minds and advocates, who is not just a reformer in the superficial use of that term, but an activist who wants us to go deeper, understand the system, understand how it's destroying, you know, our culture and our society and what we can do about it. And that's what I think brings you to attention, the attention of so many people who respect your work. And I'm hoping to see you in Madison later this summer and talk about how we might conspire to do more than we're doing now. Thank you again, Bob McChesney. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org and share your views and suggestions for how we can do what we're doing a little bit better than we're doing it. I blog at newsdissector.net. Mediachannel.org is a website that's been around for a long time, and I think is getting better, even if I'm bobbling my words a bit here in this superheated studio. But nevertheless, thank you again for being with us. See you next week.